So, welcome to our third instalment of Inside Lane here on Runner's World. We're here with Dr. Ross Tucker, and we've had a great time over the last couple of days talking a little bit about the, not just a little bit, a lot about the World Athletics Championships in London. Last night was a big night in terms of the blue ribboned events of the of track and field, the 100 metres, of course.
Spicy.
Spicy indeed.
Spicy.
And if those of you are watching, I'm sure we saw the reaction of the crowd, I think almost a reaction of disbelief that Bolt had lost. I think anybody suggested that Bolt would lose. We were talking about it yesterday, but neither of us actually were prepared to say he could lose. We were both saying, well, maybe he should just shade it, but he didn't. Bronze medal was, I don't think anybody would have thought bronze for Bolt last night.
Yeah, we chickened out of committing. that's us speaking. Sorry, let me just turn that down. Apologies. We did say though that we wanted to see the semis.
Yeah. What did we see in the semis?
Well, we saw him get his second consecutive dreadful start.
Yeah.
Just so poor.
Yeah. So we're talking Bolt here, obviously.
Bolt. Yeah. And that's not completely unusual because the tallest guy in the field historically does struggle to start the fastest. Mm. But so conceptually, we're used to seeing Bolt start slowly. But as a matter of scale, I don't remember seeing him that far behind guys who are not Gay and Blake and Powell at their peak, you know. I mean, in that semi-final, he was clawing back distance, and he got Coleman.
Yeah.
And you thought, okay, Coleman's clearly quick out the blocks.
Because he was absolutely unbelievable out the blocks, Coleman. I mean, he probably had 5 meters on everybody.
In both races, he was the quickest guy. And we'll talk about some numbers shortly.
Yeah.
Because they tell quite an interesting story. So anyway, in the semi, we see Bolt looking un-Bolt-like. Well, less Bolt-like than normal, right? And so at that moment, there's enough reason to doubt.
In fact, somebody described watching Bolt starts as watching an old person getting out of a wheelchair.
Yeah, he
it wasn't quite as bad as that, but relatively speaking, it wasn't a bad.
It's a little harsh, yeah. but yes, I mean the you know, and in response, so last night I got onto Twitter and I was posting a few stats because we looked at, you can find the reaction time of the guys and so on. And in time, the IAAF is doing this big biomechanics study in London. And they will have split times from this 100-meter race for 10-meter, 20-meter, 30-meter. And then you'll be able to really understand how the race unfolded. But what we saw in the semi and the final was Bolt losing big ground. And when we did the preview show last Tuesday, we said then already that if Bolt can tap you on the shoulder with 50 to go, he's winning. And he couldn't do that in either of those two races. And so he'd lost just enough ground that the Americans weren't coming back. Now, had you put Bolt 2009 into that race with that start, I think he still would have caught them. Because his closing in that 2009 race was so good that I reckon he would have been able to overcome the deficit. But this is not Bolt 2009. Yeah. He's 8 years on from that. And even though Gatlin and Coleman were not shooting the lights out, I mean, 9.92, you know, is the only since 1996 when Donovan Bailey won the Atlanta Olympics, only twice has a world or Olympic title been won in 9.92 or slower.
Okay.
So that was in 2003, sure. Kim Collins won it, and Blake in 2011 won it in 9.92. So it was not historically slow, but it wasn't great. But Bolt still couldn't do it because he's just lost that Boltness from the last few years. Yeah. And so we spoke yesterday in the podcast about the importance of the start. The reaction times, I can tell you, Coleman was away quickest, 0.123 was his reaction time. Remember, 0.1
is
the legal limit.
Yeah.
So 0.123 means that Coleman is out of the blocks within 0.02 of legal. So that's super quick. He was the quickest in the race. Gatlin was 0.138 and Bolt was 0.182.
Right.
So the difference between Bolt and Gatlin is 0.04 and the difference between Bolt and Coleman is 0.06. By the finish line, the differences are 0.03 and 0.01.
Yeah.
And so, in other words, before they even left the blocks, Bolt had already lost the margin that he would lose the race by. So it literally came down to the start. Now that's a little oversimplified because obviously you run the race based on the start, and it's like, it's not bobsled where 99% of the outcome is determined by the push. But the point is that he just lost too much to make up, and he didn't have either the back end or the front end to win it, and that's game over. So
it was interesting that Gatlin in the semis didn't win his heat. In fact, it was won by the South African Sabini. And Sabini actually got a great start in that semi-final. But so I think people kind of underestimated. Do you think there was a chance that Bolt, because Gatlin was in the outside lane, didn't kind of realize where Gatlin was and didn't see him in the picture? I think he was almost surprised that he thought he had silver. And then you realised afterwards, and in fact, Gatlin was the one that won it. I think it was. I think everybody was a bit surprised by that.
Yeah, a little bit, because certainly watching it, you're looking at, because Coleman's away so quickly.
Yeah.
And then Bolt's chasing Coleman down, so all eyes are on 4 and 5. And meanwhile, down here in the bottom is the guy who's winning it. But Bolt couldn't have gone quicker.
Yeah.
He was chasing as hard as he could, and the guy he's chasing is Coleman. Coleman couldn't have gone quicker because he's being chased by Bolt, so he's just running for his gold medal life.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, there's a guy out of their maybe sight going faster. That it's not going to change the result, in my opinion.
So I guess the sadness of it is, in many ways, that I saw a couple of people on Twitter and on social media talking about how the crowd booed Gatlin, and it was very sorry to see that sort of thing happening, that sort of thing. But let's just sort of recount where Gatlin's history in athletics goes and why the crowd were reacting the way they were to him.
Yeah, so Gatlin is the pantomime villain of the sport. And I disagree with this narrative a little bit. Certainly the guy who's had 2 drugs bans, Gatlin, we'll talk about those, and the guy who's unrepentant about both of them and has never admitted it, has blamed other people and other things for it. You can see why that's the bad guy in the minds of the viewing public.
Yeah.
But the consequence of that is that he's been cast as the villain and Bolt as the hero. And I distinctly remember Steve Cram, who is one of the... It's a pet hate of mine, as you know, like biased media commentary especially. And Cram's one of the worst ones. And he called the Bolt-Gatlin races of 2013-15 good versus evil. And I remember him saying that Bolt had saved the sport by beating Gatlin. So part of me watched this last night and says, well, now what are you going to say? Now where are you now? Because when you set the bar at like good Bolt versus evil Gatlin and he has to beat him to save the sport, the consequence, the corollary to that is what? That the sport's now... It's just silly.
And he was hoping that Gatlin would just continue spiraling down rather than now winning the world champs.
So you build this narrative that requires, it desperately needs there to be a good guy beating a bad guy.
Yeah.
And life and sport are never as simple as this. And so that's the first problem with the whole, you know, and again, it brings us back to doping. When we did the preview, we said, we won't get through this thing without talking about it. Now you see why, because it's just, it's so pervasive. So what's Gatlin's history? In 2001... he gets a 2-year ban for taking amphetamines. That's a central nervous system stimulant. They're on the banned list because they give the athlete energy and central drive.
Okay. Central drive?
As in the brain tells the muscles to work. Stimulants. That's why people take ecstasy at nightclubs, because then you're going to dance until sunrise.
Yeah. So a heightened sense of excitement and confidence.
And that drive to be active.
Not that I know.
You've got teenage boys. You had, anyway. So blame them. He says, no, this was medicine he took for attention deficit disorder. And as a consequence of that appeal, he's reinstated a bit early. So he comes back to the sport. He then wins the world titles in the world title in 2005 and had won the Olympics in 2004. In 2006, he gets a 2nd ban, this time for testosterone. And that time, it's an 8-year ban. Should have been life because it's a second offense. But because he cooperated with authorities... And because what were called exceptional circumstances around his first test, they reduced the length of
didn't
that
he, didn't he claim that his massage therapist had rubbed testosterone cream into his legs and that's why it had happened? I mean, is that they obviously, well, they didn't accept that as an excuse, but it's a bit like, you know, Contador's in the cycling world, Contador's story about the meat that he ate. You know, it's so fantastic to believe that, you know, my massage therapist rubbed a testosterone cream. Is it possible for that to have happened? I mean, is it so far-fetched? To me, it feels far-fetched, but you're in this world, you know. Is it possible that it could happen?
Yeah, 1 in 10,000 or something. I don't know. But that's exactly what he said.
Or does testosterone appear in massage creams, for instance?
Testosterone is often given in a cream form, so when you get testosterone prescribed to you by these anti-aging clinics, it's often cream that you rub into the forearm or wherever it is. So yes, it's conceivable that it could happen,
but not as plausible as you would think.
No, I think you're more likely to eat tainted beef from a cow that's been fed up on steroids. But so anyway, that's what he says. They don't accept that, but they do accept his cooperation. So now he gets an 8-year ban. And so in neither instance has Gatlin been repentant and remorseful or shown any admission of guilt. So that's undoubtedly part of his unpopularity, because and the media portrays this, and as I say, they build this narrative. Anyhow, he comes back in 2013, and now the guy's running as fast in his 30s as he was running at the peak, supposedly peak age for a 100 guy is 22 to 25 26. So he misses, he leaves the sport at peak, and he comes back years later and he's going to get quicker and quicker, and he's running faster in his 30s than he did as an Olympic champion. So,
so 12 years between two world titles. I mean, that's a massive gap.
You're not
going to
find it.
It doesn't happen.
It's enormous. So now Gatlin becomes the poster boy for why lifetime bans should be in place. Because people are saying, well, he's obviously still getting the benefit. I think this is a more likely explanation for why he's faster now than he was then, and that's that he hasn't stopped. I mean, if the doping was helping him then, it's either still helping him now, he's either still doing it, or it never helped him to begin with. So which of the three is most likely, right?
Well, he's just peaked at the right time.
Well, he's an outlier. I mean, there are, you can look it up, actually. There are stats been done by a couple of people, and you look up age progression in 100 meter guys. Gatlin is so far the outlier that it's actually extraordinary. So yeah, so we knew that if he won it, we spoke yesterday morning here, that it would be spicy. And it was such a close race that when they crossed the line, no one knew who'd won. And when they flashed it up on the board, and A, it's not Bolt, and B, it's Gatlin. So it's exponentially worse than just the boos and so on. So
it wasn't the celebration everybody wanted at the end of the day.
No, it wasn't. Such is life, eh? No such thing as a fairy tale.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, Gatlin is easy to cast as the villain. I would caution, you know, I was just looking this morning, the 2012 Olympic final, five of those eight have been banned for doping. Gatlin,
not a good record.
No.
Yeah.
Gatlin is the one who everyone knows, and he's got two, and he's unrepentant, but he's not he's not one bad apple, you know. So,
Talking outliers, so women's 10,000 yesterday.
Wow. Yeah.
I mean, if there's anybody that's an outlier, it's the winner of that. I mean, an absolutely dominant performance.
Yeah, unlike anything ever seen in that event, she won it by 46 seconds, which is something like three times, the margin of victory is three times bigger than anything ever done before. And the manner of the win, because for 3K they jogged. I mean, they went through 3 kilometers in 10 minutes, which I'd love to do, but that for them is slow. I mean, that's 33:20 pace for 10K, super slow. And then Alma Zayana just said, "Let's go for it," and she did the second half in 14:25.
What's the world record for 5,000?
14:11, and only that 14:25 second half of a 10 is the seventh fastest, makes the seventh fastest in history.
Yeah,
in the middle of a 10 all by yourself lapping runners, it's just
and there was also an amazing K-split, wasn't there, halfway through that?
She was running 249s. She ran 3 kilometers in the middle, I think from 4 to 7, at 5k world record pace. She was under that world record pace. So we said yesterday we said Rio was spectacular, because then she did a similar thing, but from the start, broke the world record. This time she waited till 3. She lost easily a minute because of that first slow 3Ks, and she still ran just outside 30. To me, this London performance was even more astonishing than the Rio one, because of the manner in which it was achieved. And there was, as you would expect, the usual reaction on Twitter. Part of which is because she's from Ethiopia. She hasn't run once this year. In fact, since she was beaten in the Rio 5000 final, she hasn't run again.
Yeah.
So no one knew where she was. She'd pulled out of a couple of races, ostensibly because she was injured. And then she lines up on the start of this final and produces that. So you can understand why people are suspicious.
I mean, is there a... it might come across as being slightly naive here, but you talk about outliers. Is there not some evidence to suggest that there are those extraordinary athletes, and I'm not saying the people that we're talking about at the moment are them, but there's always the potential for somebody extraordinary to come along that can be just so much better than everybody else. You know, Ayana could be one of those. You know, is that such a jump in terms of science, or realistically? I mean, I guess to some extent, there's always a side of you that wants to believe that there are these extraordinary athletes that are capable of amazing things, like Bolt, for instance.
Yeah, if it were possible to conclusively identify dopers based on performance and being an outlier, then we would do it.
Mm.
But it's not. So, of course, the answer is that it is possible that there are such large outliers.
Mm.
Otherwise, you would just say it's impossible you can win by this margin, and therefore you have to be doping, therefore you're banned. And that's not going to work. That's not going to fly. So you can't do that.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's always that possibility. My attitude to it is kind of like Darwinian. You know, Charles Darwin proposed the theory of evolution and the survival of species and so on. And a big part of that model is that there are small differences make a big difference. And if you take a competitive sport, a globally competitive sport, and you expose enough people to what is close to the optimal preparation, the natural differences between them will be very small.
Yeah.
If you take a sport that is young and not competitive. So for instance, since we're with Runners World and you're the editor and so on, you know the sport well. Trail running is a new sport and it's attracted only a very small portion of the world's runners. And so it's not unusual in a 100-mile race to see 20-minute victory margins because you don't have the depth and quality of people in the sport. But the truly global sports, football, track and field, it's difficult for me to believe that those margins would exist without some artificial separation.
But and if those people did exist, they would literally be one in a billion, you know. Not as common as we see them.
Right, and because there are 7 billion people, you'd get one or two per generation.
They would
be there.
Yeah.
But here's the problem, right? So Ayana's from Ethiopia. In the last week, two big stories have come out of Ethiopia. One concerns what they're calling almost a slave trade in athletes, where European agents are going into Ethiopia and they are paying these athletes to come and base themselves in Europe or, as we discussed last week, Qatar, Bahrain, Turkey. And they are exploiting them, taking money from them, putting them up in really poor living conditions, but just making money off them for a few years because there'll be another one in the future. But the second one was on doping, and two reporters go to Ethiopia, and they buy 12 vials of EPO from a pharmacy, just over the counter. Reporter walks in, she says, I'm struggling with anemia, someone said you sell EPO and it'll help me. The pharmacist goes away, and they buy the stuff for $80, just over the counter.
Yeah.
And there's no testing there either. So the problem is this, I'm a scientist, as many of you have told me on Twitter, so thank you for that. And science is supposed to be about data.
Yeah.
Like get the data, analyze it, make a conclusion or interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with doping and anti-doping is that the sports have lost so much credibility that we are currently in a time that the lack of data, as in tests, is the data. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The lack of evidence on... So how many times has Ayana been tested in the last 9 months? I'd be highly surprised if it's even twice, because she's isolated. She's in rural Ethiopia. No one knows. She's not competing.
But the athletes do have to let testing officials know where they are at all times. They do often get, you know, you hear of athletes literally being in a situation where they'll be woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning by a testing official, and they're in the middle of nowhere. So they do have that. Those checks.
So,
and I'm assuming that she would have the same check given how fantastic her performance at the Olympics last year was.
Right, so there's a whereabouts rule where you have to inform your authorities where you will be for 1 hour of every day.
Yeah.
So most athletes will say between 8 and 9 a.m. I'm going to be at my house.
Mm.
If I'm traveling, I'll be in this hotel, I'll be in that bed and breakfast, whatever it is.
And if you don't do that,
if you're not there,
you can get banned just by not being there.
Yes, 3 strikes.
Yeah.
So once warning, twice warning, third one done.
Yeah.
So yes, but the problem is that much of that testing is outsourced to the national anti-doping federations, mm-hmm. and then you've got to ask, are they functional? Mm-hmm. And we've seen in the last few years a number of anti-doping organizations have been declared dysfunctional. Mm. Russia, Ethiopia, Turkey, Kenya, even Jamaica, they just don't do the volume of tests. So the question is again, how many times would IANA have been tested in the last 9 months? And for that matter, why stop with her? Mo Farah trains out of Kenya a lot. That's part of the reason there are questions about him. So, and all the East Africans. So that's the problem, is that we would love there to be data to be able to say, this is what the data, but there isn't that data, and that becomes
the problem. Yeah.
That is the evidence of the problem, is the absence of evidence. If that sounds circular, it's because it's a hell of a catch 22.
Now, there is a good drug story from last night. If there's any such thing as a good drug story, Luvo Monyanga, the South African, wins gold medal in the long jump. Mm. In fact, one of two South Africans, along with Rochelle Somai. I mean, an incredible, I mean, as a South African, to think that we'd be looking at a world championships where we'd have two gold medalists who have literally probably taken the confidence of people like, forget his name now very briefly, but Kotsi Mokoena. So Kotsi Mokoena comes along, he becomes a great triple jumper, long jumper.
Yeah.
Suddenly there's these incredibly talented guys. But Luvo Monyanga, you can look it up. There's a great story on the Guardian newspaper. You can search for it on Google. But an amazing story about a guy. He in 2011, he finished fifth. He came back to South Africa. He lost all his money. Went back on methamphetamine, which is known in South Africa as tick. And then suddenly he gets rescued and brought back to the sport and wins gold. I mean, it is a fantastic international story.
Yeah, as much as you can find many reasons to be skeptical about the sport and even what's happening inside the stadium, the Manyonga story outside the stadium is extraordinary. It really is amazing. And he was under pressure a little bit last night, but he came through. He didn't produce the kind of jump that we'd seen him do earlier this year.
He's done an 868, hasn't he?
865 at altitude.
There you go.
And then he went to the Diamond Leagues and I think did an 862 in the Netherlands, not in a Diamond League, and then an 861 or an 860. Mm. So he has four jumps or five jumps this year that are 20 centimeters further than the next best guy. So that's the definition of big favorite.
Yeah.
But
then he jumps 848.
And he jumps 848 in response to the American Lawson, who jumped 843 straight off the bat, you know. So this was a good competition to watch, you know. There was lots of tension because it was close, and it went right down to the last round, and it was and he came through. So good for him, because Mike said there's a story. Donald McRae is the journalist, and it's a hell of a story.
Yeah,
the characters in it are worth the time you'll take to read it alone.
Yeah.
It's a
movie,
who,
isn't it? I mean, it really is.
Oh, someone must buy those rights for
absolutely,
sure.
Absolutely.
So that's good. I mean, and for South Africa, that's a good start, because first and third, Simbini would have been disappointed to be fifth again. You know,
but he's the next generation, I would imagine.
He would have hoped to move up at least one place, if not two, onto the podium. But long jump, we are healthy. And quite why that is, and we've managed to produce this batch of sprinters, is, I guess, a topic of some discussion.
What are the theories? I mean, is it not just the fact that you have some amazing, I mean, people like Wade van Niekerk, guaranteed that a whole generation of 400-meter, 200-meter athletes will come through? We talked about when Llewellyn Herbert, who was a great 400-meter hurdler, came through in the late 90s, and suddenly there was a whole sort of plethora of 400-meter hurdlers that came through, including people like LJ van Zyl. I think once you suddenly have heroes that develop and prove that they can compete at a world level, suddenly this new generation comes through. It's almost like a confidence boost. Well, he did it, and he's South African. We must be able to do it.
Yeah, so that's the cultural component of success, and it is significant. Mm. It's the reason that India produce cricketers and New Zealand rugby players and Canada ice hockey players and so on, because that's what you grow up with and you emulate rather than create. So that makes a difference. I don't want to sound too much like Matthew Syed selling this as the only thing, but the thing you got to bear in mind is that, okay, so Herbert and the 400 hurdles, fine. Mokoena, in the 800 we had some, and sometimes it turns into next generation, others it doesn't. Where are our 800 guys who've inherited the baton from Lao Tzu, for instance? We don't have them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
at its simplest, you can only get better collectively if one of a few things happen. You've either got to get better athletes the same opportunities, you've got to get the same athletes better opportunities, or a combination of the two. That's the only way it works. Now, how do you get better athletes into the sport? Is some kind of system-wide, centralized approach that's going to look for who's the next guy who's going to win a title and bring him in. We don't do that. I've got no hesitation in saying that that's not the secret here.
You see, I mean, essentially, and I guess fundamentally, I disagree with that, because while you can provide opportunities, if you look at the great nations that have come through, as you've suggested, there's a cultural part of that.
Yeah.
And if you look at, you know, the Kenyans, for instance, they don't necessarily have a development program. They just have a whole, there's a lot of people have, that Kenyans that have obviously participated at world-class level that encourages other Kenyans.
So
people often say to me, what's the best form of development? I think the best form of development is to develop your best athletes into world beaters, because that will draw more people into the sport and prove what is possible. You know, it's always been my theory, but I get what you're saying.
No, it can do. And so I would say the difference with Kenya is that Kenya doesn't produce great runners. That there's a tribe in Kenya that does. And the geographically, it's so concentrated around a really small population that contagious kind of behavior is possible. So we're not actually disagreeing too much, but the point I would make is that it's not as though there's been some single directive from the governing body to say this is the plan.
Yeah.
And we're going to put people all around South Africa, which is a relatively large country, and we're going to try and find people. What's happened is there's one pocket in Pretoria, there's one pocket in Cape Town, there's another one in Bloem, and so independently they seem to have figured out how to provide those opportunities. But for me, the answer lies more in better opportunities for the existing athletes. We've always had track and field athletes, but they've run 10.1 instead of 9.99. And so that little shift is, and here again, you cannot have this discussion without acknowledging that there are certain things in our context and our environment that need to perhaps be looked at. And I don't want to be always negative about the doping, but in South Africa, we have a school problem with access to steroids. And we know it from rugby and from other sports, is that doping is freely available at schools. And so there is that, that I would, that does make me a little bit nervous. And in 2012, we had 10 track and field athletes fail tests in the first 3 months of the year. I was looking that up the other day. So there is this possibility, which cannot go ignored.
Yeah.
Nothing is stuck. So I don't know of a specific association between an athlete and a dodgy coach like we do for many other athletes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know of a spate of positive tests in the groups and with athletes who work with. So I don't know that, but that possibility exists. My feeling, though, is that we've just gotten better systems together on a scattered, organic kind of level. Better medical support, better nutrition support, better scientific support, better coaching. And the consequence is now there's a batch of athletes here, there's a batch of athletes there, and there's a batch of athletes there.
We're going to try and do tomorrow's podcast and not talk about drugs at all. I think we're going to try that tomorrow. But let's just have a look to tonight's events. I think after all the hype of last night, you know, it kind of feels like we're a bit in the... it's not as exciting tonight, but there's the Women's 100. Yeah. And when you talk about Women's 100, you think, well, hang on, who's there? Who is there?
Well,
who should we be watching?
That's as with the men, Women's 100 is often USA, Jamaica. And it has been owned by Jamaica since 2008, I think. You go back and you look at who's winning those titles. On an individual level, it was Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce was the Jamaican champion for many years, up to the Olympics in London, and since then it's been Elaine Thompson of Jamaica. So she goes into this final, will go into this final as the favorite. She's the Jamaican champ, fastest in the world this year, and the Olympic champion. Then on the American side, Tori Bowie, they say, I would have said Bowie, but there you go. She's probably the big she's probably the big challenger. But there's a host of others. Daphne Skippers is a well known name from the Netherlands. I think she's a little off where she needs to be to really challenge, certainly for gold.
She won the Olympics title?
Or she's won a 200 meter world title.
That's right. Yeah,
but the 100, I think, will be just out of reach for her. And then there's a couple others. Talu. Is there a Hore? So it's open, but I think Elaine Thompson is is ahead clear of everyone else and is certainly the woman to beat. So, again, same as last night, you'll have semis and that'll be a good gauge, and then you'll know who's in a position to go on and win.
Just kind of feels not as exciting as Bolt, but I suppose that's always the case when somebody of his stature sort of disappears and that's all the hype. I mean, I think if you're a journalist there, you're struggling to figure out what to write today at the end of it because of all the stuff that happened last night.
So
marathons also today. We won't talk too much about those because they're kind of happening as we're speaking here live on Facebook. If you want to interact with us, so you can follow obviously Runner's World on Twitter. Ross is on Twitter at @sportscienceofsport. Which you can interact and share some of your thoughts with him on Twitter. And we're also live. You can also post a comment as we're live at the moment. And then a bit later on, we'll be posting the podcast just below here on Facebook. And you can actually just download that on your phone and listen to it in the car when you're taking your kids to school tomorrow morning, whatever you want to do. But we'll be throughout the week, we're going to be chatting World Championships right through to the finish of the World Championships and kind of giving you some science behind it and some of the controversies that exist. Very quickly, 400 metres tonight, Wade van Niekerk, Olympic champion, world record holder. He's just kind of going out there to get through to the next round. And 110 metre hurdles as well.
Yeah, so the 400 heats were interesting because the big favourites all won there. It's Curly, Makwala, Tebe of Botswana. That's going to be an interesting story. Botswana's 4x400 relay, by the way, but that's for the end of the champs. And then for Niekerk, so the big five all won, but very differently. So some of them went off super fast and then jogged in, and Wade hung back and sprinted the finish. So that's building up to be a nice race. So the semis are tonight. That'll show a little bit more because you'll have to be quicker there. Men's 800 semis are tonight, which will be very interesting. None of the medalists from Rio are in this event, so it is wide open for someone new to win this title. And then the 110 hurdles, so I think it's not a night full of medals on the track. There's a few field event finals, but it's this tonight will set up tomorrow and Tuesday.
I think just to finish off, I think one of the nicest things, and we'll see what happens tonight, but obviously the crowd support has been amazing the first two nights. Let's see if it's the same tonight, but it certainly seems to have been a great venue. You know, we've seen track and field numbers for the Diamond League not being particularly good. You just have to look at the crowds in the stands, but it seems like London is really coming to support this event.
If you're an athlete and you're going to get one World Championships in your career, you'd want it to be this one. Because it must be, from an organizational point of view, from a crowd support, it's just close to, they pull it off so perfectly. It's just unbelievable. Imagine you work for your whole life to run your Olympic or world final in front of 6,000 people in a stadium that's 10% full. I mean, that would be soul destroying. But London, they recognize, I think, the occasion, and they do it really well. It's been amazing.
So stick with us throughout the week. Don't forget the marathons are on very shortly if you're watching us live. And don't forget to download podcast a bit later on. And tomorrow morning, we'll be back at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. We're going to get back onto schedule, being a bit later today because it is Sunday. But throughout the week, it'll be 10 o'clock every morning on Facebook Live, and the podcast will be available a bit later. But Ross, thanks very much for your time today.
Yeah,
and
thanks.
We'll see you tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.
Very good. Thank you.